Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today on this archive edition of Midday, my guest is Dr. Hari Hahn, a political scientist who heads the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins, a scholarly and public forum that is dedicated to advancing the kind of dialogue that expands civic engagement and gets people speaking with each other instead of talking over each other. In October, Hari Hahn was chosen as a 2025 MacArthur Fellow, one of only a handful of political scientists to be designated as a MacArthur Genius. Her latest book is a fascinating study of how a huge megachurch in Ohio wrestles with the thorny issues of race and political divisiveness and the lessons that can be learned in this fraught political moment. It's called Undivided: The Quest for Racial Solidarity in an American Church. We spoke in the fall of 2024. Hari Hahn joined me in Studio A. It's great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Great to see you, too. Thanks for having me.
I loved this book.
Oh, thank you.
This is a really fascinating portrait of this singular church in Cincinnati, which is ginormous, and we'll talk about it, but also the larger implications for what it means in this, you know, very strange, polarized moment. Let's talk about the Agora Institute. That
sure.
comes from a Greek term. This is the thing you had at Hopkins, and it's you know, connection to political dialogue. What do you do over there?
Sure. So the SNF Agora Institute is an institute that is dedicated, as our tagline says, to realizing the promise of the ancient Agora in modern times. And so for people who know their ancient Greek history, the Agora was the marketplace where people came together to go shopping, to engage. You know, it was sort of like a public square where people came together. Socrates would be teaching, you know, neighbors would be exchanging conversation and favors and things like that. And so what happened in the Agora is that people learned the basic habits and capabilities and motivations for living in community with each other. And so that the premise of a lot of the work that we do is the idea that the proverbial agora has been fundamentally transformed or hollowed out in so many democracies around the world. And part of what we're trying to do is harness the resources of the university, research, teaching, scholarship, to try to recreate the promise of the agora in modern times. And so we do everything from teaching and research to events and convenings that are trying to query this question of how we can understand and strengthen democracy in America, but also in other places around the world.
And is the aspiration consensus? Is the aspiration, you know, persuasion and changing people's minds?
No, absolutely. I mean, the aspiration is absolutely not consensus, right? I mean, you know, democracies have to make decisions, right, ultimately. But you don't always make decisions through consensus. You often make decisions through compromise, through negotiation, through this question essentially of, you know, people grappling with this notion of how is it that we come to forge a common life together, right? And we all do that in our families, and we learn that if you're trying to construct a family, you have to make compromises sometimes, you have to make choices, you have to discuss different things. And if you imagine that being happening on ever bigger scale, like that's ultimately what democracy is about. But those aren't natural habits that we're born with, right? I don't come out of the womb knowing how to negotiate those kind of outcomes. And so the whole notion of the Agora is that because people aren't born with those capacities, they need places to go to learn and practice them. It's kind of like going to the gym, right? Like I go to the gym to strengthen my physical muscles, and I need to go to the gym to strengthen my, or the Agora, the Agora-like gym to strengthen my small D democratic muscles. And so, you know, the idea is not necessarily that we're going to always come to agreement, but instead we're going to learn how to disagree productively. We're going to learn how to negotiate difference. We're going to learn how to forge a common life with people who might be different from us.
So you're a political scientist.
I am.
You've written books about organizing and about, you know, democratic movements in the United States. How did you come as a political scientist to writing about a megachurch in Cincinnati?
So I totally happened upon this project by accident. I was actually doing research on a campaign in Cincinnati that was a ballot initiative for universal preschool in 2016. And it was kind of the surprising campaign that I'd heard about because if you remember in 2016, it was a Clinton-Trump race. Trump took Ohio. In the same year that Trump took Ohio, this ballot initiative, which is a new tax on Cincinnati residents to essentially fund universal preschool with targeted resources for the poor Black community in Cincinnati, was passed. And it passed by the largest margin of any new education levy in Cincinnati history. And so it just seemed kind of like a disconnect between these other patterns.
How does Trump win in the same election that this initiative passes?
Right, exactly.
That's crazy.
And so I was there just as a political scientist trying to investigate what happened in this campaign. How do we understand the dynamics of how it was able to kind of buck this trend that we saw in other parts of the country? And people kept telling me, you know, there's this church and they're sending all these volunteers, which is very common when you study these kind of campaigns. But usually it's, you know, five people in a basement who made a few phone calls when they say that. But instead, this was a group of hundreds of volunteers who dedicated hundreds of hours. They were much younger than the average profile of church volunteers, and they were both Black and white people coming together to participate. And it turned out that all these volunteers came from this one mega church because they had participated in this program around racial justice called Undivided. And so I thought, okay, like that is really unusual. Not only is the ballot initiative unusual, but the fact that so much of the ground game was driven by volunteers from this evangelical megachurch is unusual. And that's how I came into it.
And they identified a bunch of people who voted for Donald Trump and voted for this levy, voted to tax themselves to pay for preschool for largely, you know, kids of color in the poorer neighborhoods of Cincinnati. So that seems like a political trick that any politician would be delighted to know how to do. Do you have any sense that, because your report's about 250 people from this church, were they themselves split politically, supporters for Secretary Clinton, supporters for Mr. Trump?
Yeah. So one thing I should specify. So Trump won the state of Ohio, but Cincinnati is based in Hamilton County and Clinton won Hamilton County. So the urban centers are more progressive than other parts of the state in Ohio. But the margin by which.
And that's true probably all around the country.
It's right? True nationally. Yeah.
Right.
The margin by which the education levy passed relative to Clinton's victory means that you had to have some voters that were crossover voters in the ways that that you're describing. But in terms of your question. Yes, I do. You know, the church, which is called the Crossroads Church, it's the third largest evangelical megachurch in America, absolutely holds together people who are both Clinton supporters and Trump supporters in the church. And I think both of those kinds of supporters, you know, were part of this program called Undivided. The people in Undivided, I think, in some ways represented a group of people who didn't really feel well represented by either political party. So they were people of faith who were committed to things like racial justice. They felt, I think, maybe aligned with Democrats on questions of racial justice, but alienated by the fact that, you know, Democrats have a perception as being not as friendly to Christian voters. But then they felt not, you know, more aligned by faith with the Republican Party, but then misaligned in terms of other issues. And so I think a lot of people were politically homeless, so to speak, and weren't, you know, were kind of navigating their own path through politics.
The book is called Undivided, The Quest for Racial Solidarity in an American Church. The author is my guest, Dr. Hari Han from the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins. She also teaches political science at Johns Hopkins. So, Hari, one of the many interesting things in this book, which I just really like so much, towards the end of the book, you talk about another petition to get another issue on the ballot,
mm-hmm.
Which had to do with prison, the prison population
and
justice for prisoners. And that one didn't do so well.
Right.
So what was the difference between, you know, the initiative for Head Start or for early childhood education and another, you know, sort of lefty initiative later on that failed?
Yeah, so there's a lot packed into that question. So first, there are just some basic structural differences. So the ballot initiative for universal preschool was a municipal initiative in Cincinnati. The initiative to kind of make it harder to criminalize people for a certain kind of offenses was a statewide initiative. And so being a statewide initiative,
so a bigger pool.
It was subject to a much broader set of political forces across Ohio. And so it's very hard for one church to affect the entire statewide politics. But within the Crossroads community and within the Undivided community, one of the things that the contrast between those two initiatives brought up, I think, is the difference between, or the struggle, I think, that it takes for different socio-political institutions to grapple with questions of structural injustice versus thinking about it in more localized terms. And so the ballot initiative in around universal preschool was something that had been on the political agenda of Cincinnati since 2000, right? The city had had, I don't know if people remember, but there was a police shooting of an unarmed black man in 2000 that had created 3 days of urban unrest that did millions of dollars of damage to the city. And since then, a lot of city leaders had come together saying, we need to really combat the kind of history of racialized poverty that we have. And if you look at the data, one of the most effective things you can do to combat racialized poverty is universal preschool. And so there was this kind of citywide coalition that brought together faith leaders, business leaders, philanthropists, policymakers, and so on to try to push universal preschool. It took, almost 15 years for that coalition to really see the fruits of its labor. Whereas the effort around at the state level was very different. It didn't have that same history. It didn't have that same kind of coalition that had really been forged and built over time. But the other question within the Crossroads Church that I think that happened was because the universal preschool felt like an effort that everyone could get behind. But then when it came to this question of thinking about decriminalizing certain certain crimes, that there was a lot more resistance within the church. And to me, what that is indicative of is that, nothing in the book, I think, tries to argue that either Undivided or Crossroads took some kind of formulaic perfect path from racism to anti-racism, right? But instead that it was a struggle. And what was interesting to me about it was that both they as individuals and they as institutions committed to staying in that struggle, but it meant they were tacking back and forth. And I think the different reactions to those two initiatives is just one example of the ways in which they were constantly tacking back and forth as an institution.
To make sure folks understand the different terminology, Undivided is the core the program, mm-hmm. the anti-racism program that was initiated by the people at this church, which is called the Crossroads Church. You mentioned it's the third largest mega church in the country. And when we talk about large, this thing is huge.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about the Crossroads Church.
Sure. So when I first started working with the Crossroads Church and when Undivided first began, it was a church of about 20,000 people, which means that 20,000 people showed up each week. So it's not just 20,000 people are on the list and you get some subset of that, but they had about 20,000 people showing up each week. Now, the latest numbers that I've seen is they get about 35,000 people who show up each week spread across, I think, 9 different campuses and about 500,000 people who tune in online. And just to kind of give you a sense of the scope, like that's much larger than any kind of political advocacy organization that we have. Even some of the more iconic kind of large organizations can't bring together that many people on a weekly basis. But it's also part of a much broader trend of mega churches in America. And so I didn't know this before I started doing this research, but in the United States, the top 9% of churches by size contain 50% of the church-going population. Right. And so you've probably heard stories of, churches dying off and things like that, which is true that small churches are dying off. But
and denominational churches are dying off.
And denominational churches are also struggling. A lot of the growth edge in Christianity is tilting towards these large churches. And so the average megachurch between 2015 and 2020 grew by 34%. Right. So these churches kind of represent the growth edge of Christianity in America. And, I myself did not grow up in an evangelical background. And so before I started this work, I think the stereotype that I had is that all of these churches are, cauldrons of Trump voters and things like that. And what I found when I went to Crossroads and a lot of other churches that I began to get to know through the process of this research is that there's actually a lot more heterogeneity in this community than might be commonly understood to people who are outside of it. And there's a lot of work that these churches are still doing in creating communities that bring different kinds of people together in a way that a lot of our other institutions don't.
It's a predominantly white church, but there's a somewhat significant contingent of people of color in the church as well. Is that unusual?
Yeah, so when Undivided began, the church was about 80% white, 20% non-white. And because it's Cincinnati demographics, it's about the majority of the non-white population was black. A lot of the mega churches actually are becoming a lot more diverse. And so I think I don't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head, but I know that between 2010 and 2020, when we've seen this data tracked, that something like, I want to say something like 2/3 of megachurches in America count as being diverse, which is defined as having at least 20% of the population be non-dominant population. So it could be like a black church with 20% non-black population, or it could be like a white church with 20% non-white population or something like that. But I think that 2/3 of megachurches fulfill that criteria.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, the megachurches are going against the trend of organized religion in general, not just in the United States, but in Europe and a lot of other places. But the largest megachurches in the world actually aren't in the United States even, right? They're all over the place.
Yeah, the largest megachurch in the world is in Seoul, South Korea. I think the second, third ones are like in India and Lagos, Nigeria. I mean, they're in, you know, these other countries. Like, there's a very big kind of global movement around evangelical megachurches. And the churches in the U.S. are, in some ways, it gives you a very narrow, looking only at those churches gives you a very narrow view of the global movement that is evangelicalism.
Just last week, I talked to a terrific scholar from the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies, a guy named Matt Taylor, who wrote a book called The Violent Take It by Force, and it's about this radical evangelical movement that is behind Donald Trump. They were behind the protests and the insurrection on January 6th, etc. And one of the points that he makes is that the spiritual advisor of this movement that he talks about, called the New Apostolic Reformation, is a guy named Peter Wagner. Mm-hmm. And Wagner's specialty was church growth. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you can be an expert in church growth.
Yeah.
So he knew how to attract more and more people. And then he's got all these, you know, disciples and apostles and prophets and people that you know, are adherents to this. And their whole deal is bumping up their numbers.
Yeah.
They know how to do this.
Yeah. I was actually really interested to learn that history because, you know, so in my day job, like, a lot of what I study is social movements and community organizing and the science of how it is that we engage people in collective action in different ways. And what I realized in working with Undivided and Crossroads and getting to know this entire faith community is that a lot of the core questions about organizing are inherent to a lot of what the church growth movement is trying to do. And the history of the church growth movement, you know, really comes out of a missionary tradition that has long been a part of both evangelicalism, but Christianity in general, all over the world. In the kind of early to mid 20th century, that church growth movement began to work. A lot of people began to kind of bring that together with people that were focused on, like, business growth, essentially, and corporate principles for growing their customer base. And, you know, just like a company might think about how is it that we're going to market our product in order to get more clients, you know, church growth people began to think about the same thing, where the client or the product essentially was Jesus Christ, you know, and they're applying the same kind of principles of growth to trying to understand how is it that we bring more people into the door. And, you know, when I got to know, I mean, Crossroads is unlike any church that I've ever been a part of. I was raised Catholic. And so, you know, my experience at church is that there's a steeple and there's a priest and there's vestments and there's a whole formal liturgy. And, you know, Crossroads, one of their taglines when they first began was this idea that we want to be church for people who reject religion. Right. And so the idea is that there might be people who have rejected,
and it's a brand, yeah,
formal organized religion, mm-hmm, but they want to create a community for it. So they want it to be fun. You know, the services are multimedia, multisensory affairs. They dim the lights in the auditorium. There's a band on stage. The pastor preaches in jeans. You know, there's no kind of formal liturgy in the same ways. So it's a very different experience than what I understood church to be when I was growing up.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the four particular people at the Crossroads Church whom you follow through this journey of Undivided, this racial tolerance, racial understanding program at the Crossroads Church. Dr. Hari Han, the new book is called Undivided, The Quest for Racial Solidarity in an American Church. In addition to directing the Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins, Dr. Han is the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Professor of Political Science and Faculty Director of the P3 Research Lab at Hopkins. So we'll have more with Hari Han on the other side of a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Stay with us. And welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is the author and political scientist Dr. Hari Hahn, the inaugural director of the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Her latest book is a study of how a megachurch in the Midwest is grappling with the challenge of racism in our highly polarized political environment. She says that the people she met and profiled in this book defied stereotypes about evangelicalism, and at a time of dispiriting political polarity, it gave her some measure of optimism that communities can overcome some of the most intractable divides that we face in America. It's called Undivided: The Quest for Racial Solidarity in an American Church. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we aren't able to take any calls or online comments today. So, Hari, let's talk about the four people who you profile in this book. Two women, two men, two African Americans, two Caucasians, two people who work for the church, two people who are congregants at the church. How did you pick them? Tell us a little bit about Sandra, Grant, Chuck, and Jess.
Yeah. So when I first started doing research with Undivided, I didn't necessarily think that I was going to write a book about it. Like, I just thought it was sort of this unusual kind of program. I wanted to understand it, and I kind of came into it just thinking that maybe we'd do some surveys to get to know people. But as I got to know different people in the community, you know, they each had just such fascinating stories about what brought them to a program like Undivided, what they were learning, how it was changing them, and then how they engaged in the work thereafter. And so once I decided to write the book, then I began to try to think about, well, who would be kind of good anchor characters to be able to ground the narrative? And so Chuck Mingo is the Black pastor who started Undivided. And so he seemed like an obvious character. He grew up in the Black church in Philadelphia, moved to Cincinnati because he had a job with Procter & Gamble, eventually was called into ministry. And then, after having been a preacher at this white dominant church for a number of years and not really talking a lot about questions of race, felt in 2015, after there had been another police shooting of an unarmed Black man in Cincinnati, that he really had to speak out. And so that's really what birthed Undivided. And his own struggles in thinking about his own leadership as a Black pastor in a white dominant church, I think, is really a lot of what anchors that narrative. And so then I thought, well, who are the other characters that can, whose stories we can try to understand the way in which Undivided works? And, you know, so it's a combination of finding people who were willing to be a part of the project, but also people who could help kind of illustrate different parts of the story. And so Grant is a white man who grew up in small town Ohio, conservative Christian. He had interned at Fox News, was president of College Republicans, but he had a brother who his family had adopted when he was a baby who was Black. And because they'd grown up in a town that was 99% white, they had never really grappled with questions around racial difference, even though they were very loving and built this really wonderful community around the brother. But Undivided, you know, kind of forced him to renegotiate a lot of that relationship with his own family. And then there is Sandra, who is a Black woman who grew up in a Black conservative Christian family in California, moved to Ohio because of a guy, ended up finding Crossroads, married a white man and came to Undivided because she was kind of grappling with questions of race within her own marriage, and had a child who was going to start school and was trying to, you know, some of those questions that they had been ignoring were coming to the forefront. And then Jess is a white woman whose father had literally had the words white power tattooed on his triceps. And so she had grown up in a family that preached an ideology of white supremacy explicitly. And then she had gotten addicted to opioids in high school, had went to prison, found Jesus in prison, but then also began to rethink her questions about race in America, you know, having been in this multiracial environment in prison, but didn't really have anywhere to go until she was given the opportunity to participate in Undivided. So they each had these different journeys that brought them there. And when I started the project in 2016, you know, obviously I knew that, like, Trump was president at that point, and that whole context of sort of these struggles around race and faith and things were going on in American politics. But I had no idea there was going to be a global pandemic. I had no idea that George Floyd was going to happen. And the book follows these characters pretty much from 2016 to about like 2022 or so. And so, you know, each of them kind of ended up taking a really winding path through that time period that, you know, I couldn't have anticipated, but I think helped illustrate a lot of both the kind of promise and struggle of this kind of work.
And George Floyd, who was killed Memorial Day weekend of 2020 in May, did spurn what people now refer to as the BLM movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, protests all around the country, all around the world. They were intergenerational. They were interracial. They took place in large cities, in small cities. They took place everywhere. There then seemed to be this raised consciousness in corporate America about Black Lives Matter and about racial justice. And these DEI programs became staples of corporate life, staples of university life, staples of American life, where people were starting to think about, you know, the ways in which structural racism is nefarious and what can be done to stop it. So the Crossroads people, when they decided to have their own DEI program, because that's essentially what this is, they were aware of that, right? And they were aware of the pitfalls of those. They were aware of the fact that many of those programs, when they're done at Pepsi and IBM and, you know, large companies, don't work. They don't change anybody's behavior. You know, so what did they aspire to? What did they, you know, you mentioned Chuck Grant, or Chuck, excuse me, Lyons, is that his last name?
Mingo.
Mingo, excuse me. A preacher, a black preacher at this predominantly white church, wants to start this DEI program. What was he hoping to do differently than, you know, the DEI programs that at that point were starting to be pervasive in corporate America?
Yeah. So a lot of the DEI programs that many of us who are part of different kind of workplaces have to participate in really came, I mean, the history is they really came out of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. They really took off in the 1970s when a lot of corporations and other institutions wanted trying to think about what can we do in response to this wave of civil rights activity that's happening. And then they got tied to a lot of legalistic policies that came down, you know, to ensure that corporations weren't discriminating against their employees and so on and so forth. And so that's kind of really where that program initiated. But if you look at a lot of the data, the effects of most of these programs is very limited at best, you know, and different programs have varying levels of effectiveness. But in a lot of ways, they've almost become kind of a box checking exercise for a lot of people.
Yeah. And those limitations are self-reported. In other words, it's the HR professionals at these companies that are saying, you know, we did all this. We spent all this money on it. And it didn't work.
Yeah, there's a sociologist at Harvard named Frank Dobbin who's done a lot of research on this. And I think he has a data point that says 2/3 of HR professionals say that these kind of incidental short-term programs don't really work. And I think when Undivided began, they weren't necessarily consciously thinking like, oh, we're going to build a different kind of DEI program. But there were certain instincts that they had that I think really served them well. And one way that I like to think about it is that I think because they were coming out of a faith tradition and out of this, you know, culture that really embraced things like risk and trying new things, they had this intuitive understanding of the difference between what organizers call like getting people to do a thing versus getting people to become the kind of people who do what needs to be done, right? And a lot of DEI programs are focused on like getting me to do a thing, right? Like if I'm on a hiring committee, here are the things I must do to make sure that I'm, you know, eradicating discrimination or bias from the process, right? Or, you know, if I'm in a, you know, if, here's how I should behave in meetings or here are different things like that. But that's very different than getting someone to own the process of becoming the kind of person who's going to navigate the struggle that it takes to engage with someone across race, to engage with someone who comes from a very different life experience than I do. Because that requires a lot of uncertainty. It requires, there's no formula for how you do it right. And so in the same way that when kids learn how to ride a bike, they have to, you know, learn how to ride a bike, but then they have to get on the bike and actually try it and then fall off and try it and fall off and try it and fall off. Most DEI programs don't really give people that opportunity to try new things and risk things and then fall off and then get on that bike again. And so Undivided really wanted to make sure that they created an environment where people felt like they could take risk, you know, where they felt like they could do something different so that people would begin to own the work in a different way.
These social relationships, you also report on the data and the study of this that says eliminating systemic racism doesn't happen because individual racists are persuaded or changed. I mean, that's a good thing.
Right.
You know, you don't want to have a lot of individual racists running around. But even if you got rid of all of them, it wouldn't necessarily eliminate systemic institutional racism. That seems on a certain level counterintuitive. Like if you change individuals' minds, then you would think that the institution with whom they are associated would also change. But maybe not, huh?
Yeah, no. I think that part of the challenge is that the assumptions and biases that we have as individuals that we carry around in our head, they get baked into the socio-political institutions that we create, right? So if we assume, for example, that white people are superior to black people or that men are superior to women or whatever, then we build entire institutions that substantiate and support those kind of assumptions, so that even if you can eradicate, let's say, the bias in someone's heart, they're still stuck in an institution that is biased towards white people, towards men, towards whatever the thing may be. And that was one thing that Undivided was really clear about, is unlike a lot of other programs around racial solidarity that had existed in evangelicalism in the past, they wanted to think not only about interpersonal racism, but also about structural racism and how did that manifest in their own communities. Now, what I will say is that what that also meant is that, if you read the book, I'm not trying to argue that they have some kind of formula that they've unlocked and that if only everyone did this, that we would all live in an anti-racist world. That's not at all the case. And, the book chronicles both the way in which they're able to agitate people into action, but also the backlash that everyone receives and how they navigate that backlash. But what I think what Undivided is able to do is they cultivate people's willingness to continue to engage in the struggle, right? And they cultivate an institutional willingness to kind of continue to grapple with the hard work of doing this. But when you're grappling, sometimes you make mistakes, right? Like the institutions, I think, tack back and forth in their ability to navigate this accurately.
Undivided is a program of the Crossroads Church, which is a megachurch in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hari Hahn has written about it. The book is called Undivided, The Quest for Racial Solidarity in an American Church. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. So the example of issue 44, where this sort of journey began for you, which is the referendum, the ballot referendum that raised taxes to fund early childhood education. You mentioned that this grew off after a 15, 16 year situation. Tamir Rice was killed in Cincinnati, in early 2000. Is that movement, the 250 people from the Crossroads Church who worked diligently to see that referendum passed, is that indicative of the success of something like Undivided? In other words, is that proof positive that, an interracial coalition of people can get together, organize? I mean, because even before you wrote this book, you're an expert in political organizing. Is that a valid exemplar?
Yeah. So the way that I think about it is that, so Undivided at its core, it's a 6-week program around racial justice. It has a lot of echoes of DEI programs with the kind of differences that we've already talked about. But then after they did the first session of Undivided, they sort of realized, they had taken 1,200 people through this journey. People, they could see people's eyes kind of, opening in different ways. And they realized we can't just like drop them off at the end of this journey, right? So we have to invite them into a place where they can continue to grapple with these questions of anti-racism. And so they developed what's called these on-ramps, which were basically invitations to other ways where people could continue the work. And one of the on-ramps was what they called the Justice Team, which is essentially a structure through which people could continue their anti-racist work. And it, in that case, happened to be by volunteering on issue 44. So to me, one of the lessons that's portable out of this to other kinds of movements is that getting people involved, pulling people off the sidelines of public life is not like a one and done thing, right? You have to pull them off the sidelines and kind of agitate people's imagination about a different kind of world. But then they need some kind of scaffolding around them to be able to sustain that work. Because the, you know, in other work that I've done, one of the things that we find is that the thing that differentiates movements that are really successful from those that are not successful is not how good they are at getting people involved at the front end, but instead how good they are at keeping people involved when the going gets hard, right? Because there's never in the history of the world been an effort to make social change where they've knocked on the door of political power and said, hey, we want this change. And people are like, okay, great. You know, there's always some point when someone challenges you. And the question is, are you ready when that challenge comes?
Yeah, you quote a couple of scholars, Jennifer Chetty or Chudy and Hakeem Jefferson, who say for too many people, the journey towards anti-racism started in a bookstore and ended on their couch,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's just not, it's not in the DNA yet.
Exactly. Yeah. They're looking particularly at data about after the summer of racial reckoning that happened after George Floyd. What they find is that the pattern followed the history of 21st century social movements, where there's a huge uptick of activity, you know, right after some moment of outrage. You know, people poured into the street, dollars poured into all these efforts to engage anti-racism. And then 6 months, 12 months later, the activity drops off pretty sharply, and support for the movement for Black Lives also dropped off precipitously. And I think part of what they find is that even people who were sympathetic to the cause of racial justice didn't know what to do, right? And that's why you need that scaffolding to keep people involved.
The book is Undivided, The Quest for Racial Solidarity in an American Church. The author is my guest, Dr. Hari Han of the SNF Agora Institute and Political Science Faculty at Johns Hopkins University. We'll have more with Hari Han after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stick around. Welcome back to this encore edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Dr. Hari Han. She's the inaugural director of the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University, where she's also a professor of political scientist and the director of the P3 Research Lab, which advocates for greater participation in public life across race and class. Hari Han was named a member of the class of 2025 MacArthur Fellows for her work studying why people do participate in civic and political life. She is the author or co-author of 5 books, the latest of which is a study of how the congregation of a white-dominant megachurch in Cincinnati confronts the challenges of racial reckoning in the current climate of political polarity. It's called Undivided, The Quest for Racial Solidarity in an American Church. We spoke about the book in the fall of 2024, weeks before the election that Donald Trump won over Kamala Harris. Because our conversation was pre-recorded, we aren't able to take any new calls or online comments. Here's more of my conversation with Dr. Hari Han. By the way, I'm talking about Crossroads and this Undivided program in the present tense. Yeah, you studied it back in 2016. Is it still going? Is it still
Yes.
a viable thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Undivided program actually spun out of, it started in Crossroads. It spun out of Crossroads and developed as an independent nonprofit, which is a very common model that Crossroads uses. And so Undivided now is not only in Crossroads, but it's spread into other churches across America. They also have a secular version that they've done in some workplaces. And so there was even like a police force in a small town in suburban Ohio that took its leadership along with other city leaders through the program. So it has these tentacles that are reaching out in different ways.
So they have figured out how to monetize it.
Well, they're still trying to develop a funding model. And so, you know, because a lot of churches don't necessarily have the funds to pay for a program like this. So they're trying to figure out what the right relationship is to do this kind of work. But there's definitely an audience out there. And I should also specify that Undivided is one of multiple different faith-based programs focused on questions of racial justice. And so there's a whole landscape of these programs that are out there that Undivided is now a part of.
A couple of years ago, I don't know, 3 years ago maybe, I spoke to a terrific scholar from NYU named Pam Newkirk, who wrote a book called DEI Inc.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about this billion with a B dollar industry of these DEI programs. And of course, you know, DEI has become a hot, you know, flashpoint in electoral politics. So the people on Fox News talk about DEI in a very different way than the people on MSNBC do. Where do you think that the DEI situation sits on the landscape of politics in 2024, where we've got what some people on the right derisively call a DEI candidate in Kamala Harris. How is it going to weigh in? As a political scientist, how's it going to weigh in this election?
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with DEI and the way that you're talking about it is that it's really become weaponized in a lot of ways, and so that in our polarized political climate, that even though I think there are probably a lot of people who might who believe in diversity and equity and inclusion, the way in which it has become weaponized has politicized the ideas that underlie it in ways that aren't productive. And it's also helped fuel a backlash and a deliberate attempt to try to undermine the work of constructing racial justice. One thing I do want to clarify this, I don't know that I feel like Undivided is different from other typical DEI programs, most of which come out of corporate America. You know, for some of the reasons that we already talked about, but the other reason is that the fact that it did exist in a faith environment, I think, made it different. And for a couple of reasons, a lot of people will ask, like, is this possible outside of a faith environment? I think they think, like, you know, is people's sort of shared belief in God going to unify their willingness to do this work? And I think that's actually less relevant in what makes it different and more relevant are two other characteristics. One is that if you're part of a church community, then you inherently understand the value of collective life. And so much of American society is so individualistic that I think people who came into Undivided kind of had this instinctive understanding of, I really do want to grapple with this question of how I forge a common life with people who are different from me because I value common life, right? Because I've had that experience in my church. But the second is that, and this is true especially of evangelicalism, is that they believe inherently in the power of people's ability to transform themselves, right? Like that's the whole idea that underlies evangelicalism, is that I am born again, so to speak. And I think that you have to be willing to believe in both transformation and collective life in order to commit to the risky work that something like this kind of program takes, which is different from DEI as conventionally understood.
Sure. And you write about, two of the people you profile, Sandra and Jess, and the difficulties and the personal risks that they take being involved in this. Jess comes from, as you mentioned, a white supremacist background, a family. If she ticks off her mother and father, she loses childcare at a time when she's trying to maintain sobriety and move on with her life. Sandra, is in a marriage that is definitely affected by interracial issues and stuff. So to get involved, there's personal costs in this. It's not just systemic institutional costs.
Right. Like all of the characters kind of face both, I think, personal and professional costs in a lot of ways. Both Jess and Grant and, kind of face a backlash in their workplace that forces them to rethink what they want to do professionally. And so I think that's an important point to make, that there's no perfect formula for doing this work of racial justice, and you have to be willing to kind of think about, how it is that you commit to the struggle.
We have a couple callers. Let's go to Thomas, who's on the line in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Hari Han.
Hey, how are you? I'm pulling over, so I am stopped. I'm in the car. Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm glad you're stopped. Good. And what's on your mind?
Thank you. So, I graduated from high school in 1984 from a high school outside of Pittsburgh in a dying steel town filled with mostly, immigrants from Europe who had a death grip on the white ethos. And I have crippling ADD, no H. And so from a child, I've been able to, I clock people, because it kept me interested. So I learned how people behaved. I learned how people, it almost became predictive, and I left. But coming back to because according to the statistics, 60% of those people that I grew up with in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, voted for Trump. It wasn't surprising, given what I know. But the point is, they can be turned back. Because it is, of course, sort of like they're experiencing the vacuum of the loss of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a specific question for Dr. Han?
What I'm saying is, from a cognitive perspective, I don't think dealing with people with these types of, grievances who will, live a cordial life but go into a voting booth and vote for a fascist, they can be talked back because basically they're not questioned about their character, and the whole sort of religion experiment in America has failed.
Okay, well, thanks, Thomas. And we're a little short on time, so I want to move on. But what do you think? I mean, Thomas uses the phrase "they can be talked back." Is this an election, for example, that has a bunch of persuadable voters?
Yeah. So actually, I think the point that he's making is an important point, which is that a lot of us have heard the statistic that 8 in 10 white evangelicals voted for Trump, and that is true. But that is why 8 in 10 self-identified evangelicals. And one of the things that we know is that the people who identify as evangelical when they're talking to a pollster often adhere to the political identity of white evangelicalism, but not necessarily the faith identity. And there are people who might adhere to the faith identity in the sense that they believe in the basic theological tenets of evangelicalism. But when a pollster says, "Are you evangelical?" they're going to say no, because they feel like they don't adhere to the political identity. So there's a lot of confusion in the data, I think. And one of the points that I hope people take from the book is the idea that there is more heterogeneity in the white evangelical community than is commonly understood. And so if you take that seriously, then yes, I think there absolutely are people who are feeling politically homeless in the ways that we talked about earlier, that are seeking someone who's going to speak into the vacuum that they're experiencing.
You quote one scholar, a guy named Robertson, I think, who says that there's a lot of political advocates who take years to learn the fact that scale and power are not the same thing.
Right.
So if you have lots of people doing stuff, that's a good thing on a certain level, but it doesn't necessarily translate directly into, actionable power.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the point that we were talking about before, which is that at the point at which your commitments are tested, when you're getting politically challenged, if you have a million people who sign a petition but aren't going to stand with you in that moment of challenge, then that's not necessarily as powerful as having 100,000 people to whom you're actually in relationship with that are going to stand with you in that moment of challenge.
Given your work and study of political organizing in our last 30 seconds here, this particular election, we hear about all these volunteers signing up to work for Kamala Harris. It wasn't happening during the Biden campaign. It is happening now. 29,000 people signed up to volunteer on the first day she announced her candidacy. She's got 1,000 field offices. Trump has 250-something. Does this give her a distinct advantage? How do you think this election is going to play out?
I mean, I think if you look at the data, then what we know is that structural factors matter a lot in affecting election outcomes, the state of the economy, state of foreign wars, like all of these kind of things. But that field campaigns tend to really matter at the margins. And this is an election, I think, that is going to be decided at the margins. And in that sense, having a field office versus not, if it comes down to 2 counties in Wisconsin that are going to determine the outcome of the election, it could make a real difference whether or not you have neighbors talking to neighbors, having compelling conversations about why they support one candidate or the other.
Well, this book is a really, really good read for understanding so many of the nuances and the intricacies of our current political moment. So congratulations on it, and thanks for coming by and talking about it.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun.
Dr. Hari Han. We spoke in the fall of 2024 about her book, Undivided, The Quest for Racial Solidarity in an American Church. That's it for us today. Thanks for listening to Midday on the radio or on demand. Thanks for subscribing to our podcast. And thanks, if you're so inclined, for leaving us a review. And coming up next after news at the top of the hour, it's Fresh Air. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.